Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I've chosen one of my favorite books of the last several years. It's Ann Beattie's A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, and it seemed like time, because I'm always being asked about favorites, to choose a favorite. This is a book that was largely neglected and stayed deep in my mind until this very day. I'm very pleased to reintroduce Ann Beattie and A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, published by Viking. As most of my listeners will know, Ann Beattie is one of the most respected writers of short stories. In fact, one of the most respected writers in America. When I read one of her books of short stories, I know the level of accomplishment that will accompany it, and I read them as often as I can. This novel, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, is fascinating to me because as soon as you turn the pages to the epigraph, we're given a slap in the face. The epigraph is, "Remember that sometimes not getting what you want is a wonderful stroke of luck." Now, that's the way this book works. Anything that happens gets reversed, usually within a couple of pages, sometimes in the following section, and we're living on tenterhooks as readers to see just what's going to happen in this book. This book has more births and deaths than any other book of yours that I can think of. And forget about births and deaths. Sometimes it's just a squirrel falling out of a tree into the hands of people who are holding hands. There's no such thing in this book as being secure. Did you know that? Did you write that kind of book? I'm going to reverse every expectation that the reader has?
Well, part of the answer to that would certainly be that I didn't have a preconceived notion of the main character, Ben, but the book closely follows his perceptions. And at first, he's a young man and has different kinds of concerns and confusions. And then later in the book, he's quite a different person, but the world in which he moves in is often largely out of his control, even though it's school. Well, what school child feels I am in control of the situation at my school? I mean, that just isn't the way that young people think. But similarly, with relationships, with world events, with information that comes to him late in life that he has not had knowledge of, that he's been operating in the shadow of, it's as though I began to realize that because of the larger world itself, the sands were always shifting.
Yes. I don't want to pull any of what people called spoilers, but I think readers should be aware that you might turn a page and discover that the characters are all 15 years older or have been married,
right,
or have been married and divorced, and that the book is administering short, sharp shocks.
I like that.
These are younger characters than previous characters. I don't mean younger. You've had very young children in your books. But these are characters who were born in the 70s or the 80s.
Yes.
And they have been sent to a private school for, pardon the word, screw-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're in a school called Bailey, a flibbertigibbet Frenchman who's so unpredictable in what he says that you think he's saying something interesting and surprising and previously unthought, when in fact...
he's messing with their minds.
Yes.
He's hugely messing with their minds, and either, at best, dissociated from his own true feelings and motivations, or rather Machiavellian.
Now, what's his name?
Pierre Lavradere.
This book has gotten rather strange reviews. Let's not say they're stranger than any other book by Anne Beattie, because Anne Beattie's books are strange. I remember when, with the last full-length work, which was called Mrs. Nixon,
yes?
And it took the form, I still can't believe it, of a writing manual in which the person writing it, teaching writing, is trying to teach you how to take a character about whom nothing is known, Mrs. Nixon, say, and present us with how you would go about drawing a Mrs. Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a wild book and so interesting. I did learn more about writing than I knew before I started it, and I thought that I knew rather a lot. This book, too, is a book that wants to throw you out of your seat with reversed expectations. Last time, they thought you were making fun of Republicans. This time round, they don't know what you're making fun of, but they have the feeling that they're not getting the joke, these reviewers. Now, I've read this book, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, by my guest Anne Beattie, three times now, and I love it more each time. Tell me what a writer, in this case Anne Beattie, feels when you flabbergast people time after time with what you thought had been clear from the time a reader reads the epigraph.
I don't really know where to begin with that observation, which I do very much agree with, your perspective, I mean. But one of the things that's going on here is that there is a lot of discussion of the inner thoughts of the characters, and almost everybody, without being totally bullish or doctrinaire, gets to voice that. It's there on the page. He thought the following, this sort of thing. But that is... always butting up in the book against the squirrel on the tree branch that loses its footing and falls to the bench, as you mentioned earlier. And it can be something huge like world events, or it can be minuscule like that small moment, you know, with the squirrel as Icarus falling out of the sky. But this idea in this book, I think, is different from Mrs. Nixon in that it isn't a moment-by-moment demonstration of something. It's more what you're saying. It's more reversed expectations or a cancellation of people's thoughts because of the physical reality, the plot of their days.
Suddenly, Ben, the central character, learns that this Frenchman has had in the past an affair with his stepmother, that he now, the Frenchman, is HIV positive, that he hasn't told his stepmother, and that Ben, poor Ben, whose life has been falling down around him since the first page, the girl he loved the most, Lulu, is no longer interested in men. Ben has to go and tell his stepmother that the man she used to sleep with is now HIV positive. They're on the phone together, and she says to him, oh, he's in my living room right now.
Right.
There's no end to the number of surprises, and none of them are spoilers, because there's nothing to be spoilt except the idea that life is unpredictable.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, underlying all of this, though, is this idea of mortality, and it's done more with the allusions in the book and more with a kind of substrata that is beneath this text, too, that is meant to be sort of omnipresent, and not just to operate metaphorically, but to be something that is culturally underlying what's happening to these people with their lives as their lives evolve.
Now, some of these mistaken reviewers have, because Ann Beattie defined a previous generation, have thought that this book is a definition of our present group of millennials. I didn't see that at all. It didn't seem like this was an Ann Beattie novel about a generation. A Wonderful Stroke of Luck is about life, and it's better not to know than to get your wonderful stroke of luck, because who knows where it will bring you.
Mm-hmm.
I
mm-hmm.
think it's a wonderful idea, thrilling, hilarious, to write a book in which nothing can be expected except the unexpected.
Well, good. I mean, I don't want the book to seem like it's hermetically sealed in that way, you know. But I do agree, I'm somewhat taken aback that it seems that people are reviewing me or their notion of me, what they think I represent or once represented, rather than reading the book at hand. I wouldn't know how to be more obvious without displeasing myself than the way I've organized this book, which, of course, I worked on for a long time. I switched the order of chapters. I combined chapters. I put things in deliberately to change things tonally.
And so it's divided into chapters, and you can see very clearly how the book operates to make you giggle at your own misimpressions. And so, you know, I recommend A Wonderful Stroke of Luck to people who've been tired of the way novels bore them. Mm-hmm. Now, how do novels bore them? Well, everyone is graduating from high school and going to New York to seek their fortune. Well, in this book, they don't get there.
And as soon as they get there, they're trying to get out.
They're trying to move away to an exurb or a suburb, and they're trying to figure out how to make a marriage last more than, 15 minutes, would you say?
Yes.
Because if something happened to fiction, in the interim, since we would talk about, you and I, about Donald Barthelme and some of our favorite writers, mm-hmm. it's that fiction became predictable.
Mm-hmm.
Not just predictable in plot, but predictable in style, too. Now, every single character in this book has a different way of speaking. Wherever you like, you can find a bright young kid screwing up and being sent to the fictional Bailey Academy, where they're all rubbing noses together with La Verdere, this Frenchman who's convincing them, the way I must say the French theorists have succeeded in our country, in thinking thoughts that are the opposite of what you'd expect. They're all being taught to live in the absence of norms. Oh. In other words, it's a novel about the present.
That's wonderful. I certainly wouldn't have been able to put that together in exactly those terms. But you're right. The master of ceremonies, La Verdere, is rather transparent to the audience, or I hope at times is transparent to the audience, in a way that someone being his student would be habituated to him, perhaps overwhelmed by him, aware of the power imbalance that always exists between student and teacher or so forth. But if he doesn't register as being a very curious fellow, not just through his actions and through the secrets he keeps, but from what he says, I mean, verbally, who he is in this book, then I don't know what you would make of the book, but it's all there.
The shortest chapter in this book is our Frenchman, La Verdere, talking about one of the most famous paintings in American art called The Peaceable Kingdom. It's that picture by Edward Hicks in which, as predicted in the Bible, the lion shall lie down with the lamb. You wouldn't recognize this picture from Gavadere's presentation.
You certainly wouldn't want to lie down with that man, though a lot of the female characters in the book apparently do.
Now, one of the critics writing about the book said that Lavardère is the essence of the person you wouldn't want to sit next to on the airplane, except I was going, bing, 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 right you are, you got it, except he was doing this as a criticism, whereas the book was asking me to see where these kids were getting so many faulty ideas from, and that Lavardère was only impressive to them because they were too young to judge.
Yes, exactly. I mean, exactly. That's what's at issue. Also, however long most airplane flights are, that's not analogous to 4 years of school. But, you know, Ben is on to him from the first. He is and he isn't, though, the way young people are. In other words, what young person doesn't have their parents' number even? What they say can be tremendously astute, tremendously insightful about their parents. But that doesn't mean that they have the ability to take on their parents. In other words, they need their parents. They have conflicting information about their parents. They don't have our experience. They're not sophisticated yet. They're just children. So this also comes into play with Lavardère. And this is where I have to trust as the writer that the reader is going to be rolling his or her eyes pretty quickly the second or third time Lavardère says something that is contradictory, abstruse, just plain wicked.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ann Beattie, one of my very favorite writers, about her book, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, one of my favorite of her books. Well, can you possibly lose? We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and this is a conversation with Ann Beattie from June 2019 about her book, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, which remains one of my very favorite books of the last several years. A gifted honor student confronts the anticlimax of real life. And it seems, if anything, that this newest book has the information that real life is rougher, tougher, more unpredictable than ever. Mm-hmm. Was this book consequently harder to write?
One thing that was difficult was that I had no preconceived notion that 9/11 would figure into this book in any way, and I didn't want to hit that too hard at the expense of its being a kind of psychological study that in which the character could lose some equilibrium for any number of reasons, not just because of, the stark truth of this national tragedy or something like that. But I did have in mind as I went along the kind of anti-romantic streak that goes through the book. And so that's sort of what you're talking about, at least
yes.
a part of what you're talking about. And this is something that the teacher addresses forthrightly. You know, he ridicules this painting by Hicks, The Peaceful Kingdom, and says, well, you know, this is just in effect, we have to look down on this because it's romanticism. Well, okay, so then if that's a free-floating idea that you look at something because it's too romantic, then let's go the other way and let's look at something that's very anti-romantic. And that, it seems, in the interpersonal relationships between Ben and various women and his parents' generation and so forth, there doesn't seem to be a lot of extraneous romanticism going on there to me either. So it's that question of where do you fall in between these polarities?
Now, toward the end of the book, Ben, who thinks to himself, oh, I no longer sleep with women as randomly and easily as I once did.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the following chapter, every time he mentions a woman, he has to say, oh, I forgot about her. And so we get the feeling that what Ben says and thinks about himself is the opposite of the truth about Ben.
Mm-hmm.
That Ben has a very, by now, as an adult, mixed up picture, that there's been nothing to come along and shake him down and let him know what kind of world he's living in, what the people in that world expect of him. Everyone likes him. He's a very likable man. Now, what's the difference here between likability and honesty?
Well, as you point out, it's not necessarily when people deceive themselves that they're cognizant of doing that, right? You know, that's sort of a built-in anxiety response or a defense mechanism or something like that. So the question is, why is he so shell-shocked before all the bombs have really fallen?
And also, why is he so convinced, he really is, that the women in this book are secretly in love with him? It's something that he learned back in prep school.
Mm-hmm.
And even La Verdere tells him, Lulu had a crush on you.
Mm-hmm.
Lulu is a character who we now know is gay.
Mm-hmm.
People say of Lulu that she wanted to sleep with Ben, except she believed that La Verdere wanted to sleep with Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you guys, but when I meet a lot of characters in a book and I don't know them, I write down their names so that when I see them again, I'm going to recognize them. This holds true for Pynchon as much as it holds true for Ann Beattie, and yet people are writing about a wonderful stroke of luck. I can't remember where I first met these characters. Well, you have a pencil and a piece of paper. These characters are being very methodically laid out so that you can see how they make the mistakes they make in the world and how those mistakes need to be corrected if these characters are to become adults. This is life. We watch people having their wonderful stroke of luck, paying for it, and growing up as a result, because sometimes not getting what you want is a wonderful stroke of luck, and the book arranges truth and untruth to keep flipping back and forth. I thought you took it all on. I think this is a book that you can be very pleased with. And then come people who just don't understand that you meant them to be shocked at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
This is very difficult, it seems to me, for a writer, because we're living in difficult times for fiction. What is fiction today except the story of how we lie to one another?
Mm-hmm.
That is the story.
That does it. Yep, that's certainly what's going on there. I mean, one thing that might be interesting, and I do this myself sometimes as a reader, I do it in general, I certainly do it as a writer, is to follow an image through, though. If you see something and the writer has made it analogous, for example, you know, phrases that would seem like a throwaway. One of the chapters ends with Ben, you know, settling into the darkness as though it's a shroud being pulled around him or something. Why the word shroud as opposed to something else? And that's probably chapter two. You know, there's a kind of relentless, but I hope subtle, I'm not trying to be didactic and have one interpretation or one rubric under which all life, you know, falls and can be explained, quite the opposite. I'm really trying to display the way that there is no nucleus, the way that there is no going back to some abstract center, or at least I consider the center as being abstract. But, you know, Ben escapes things, but to escape something does not mean that you get to something else. In other words, he does have some very unpleasant relationships, or to him, shocking or even surprising relationships with women. He does get away from those women in point of fact, sometimes by choosing other women, sometimes by being without women, sometimes by visiting with his stepmother. But whatever he does keeps him sort of in swarming himself in the same area in an odd way. He can't proceed. And yet my difficulty as a writer is that the book itself has to have a trajectory. You can do it cinematically. You can't really do it with words, because that's not interchangeable with the visuals of cinematography.
We've been talking to each other, I don't know for how many years. I mean, I'm always happy to have Ann Beattie on my show talking about her work. But I think somehow on this show, we've finally kind of done it. And I want to say that readers who now pick up A Wonderful Stroke of Luck will know how to begin. And it's really a fabulously interesting book if you start to understand that characters are seldom what they seem in this book. They're not there for you to like or for you to dislike. They're there for you to register and compare their varying value systems, which are not going to hold true from the beginning of the book to the end. Each and every one of them is going to change radically. I found reading this a great pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
And thank you, Anne, for coming in and talking once again.
I think very highly of your opinion, as you must know by now.
I of yours. Anne Beattie, to my mind, is one of the most brilliant, intelligent, moving, and really beautiful writers writing in America today. I've been talking with her, Anne Beattie, about her book, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck, published by Viking. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. It can also be listened on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. And may I say, we have an archive that will take you back to the very beginning, practically any author you would want to hear. Special thanks to Bookworm Show collaborators Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, and production manager J.C. Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.